is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
Well, the big conversation now surrounding the alleged collusion of the Trump campaign, for which there is yet any proof. Months into the investigation, multiple investigations, no proof whatsoever that Trump or his team broke any law at any time. But Jared Kushner, now the focus of intense conversation. Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, key advisor to the president, had some sort of a conversation, it's alleged, with Russian counterparts instead of a back channel for communication. That happened in December of 2016 before the president had taken office. Unprecedented? Not at all. FDR, JFK, Nixon, Obama, they all had back-channel conversations and communication with Russia and other countries that are sworn enemies of the United States. Let's not forget Barack Obama delivered billions in dollars of cash in the middle of the night on unmarked planes and lied to the American people about it. Press didn't care about that. Doesn't care that Iran has sworn to destroy the United States, ever given the possibility or the opportunity. That was ignored. But because Hillary Clinton lost the election in 2016, we get to hear on a daily basis ad nauseum about how the Russians were involved and the Russians colluded. You know, did somehow the Russians come over here and pull the levers to cast votes? No. Oh, they had bots and they put out social media. Okay. In the past, they've bought other media. The Russians have been interfering in our elections my entire life and us in theirs. In us and many other elections around the world. The United States meddles with everybody. Friend and foe alike. Breathtaking. Meanwhile, as you watch the coverage, stations like CNN, it is populated by those on the extreme left these days. On a daily basis, the likes of Chris Cuomo or Don Lemon rant on about Donald Trump and anything they can attack conservatives with. Their voices are hateful because they allegedly denounce hate, and they cry out in judgments while denouncing being judgmental. That's why I was so surprised when one of the most left-leaning agitators on CNN, Fareed Zakaria, actually admitted this weekend that the left is being intellectually dishonest. He came out and admitted that the left is being intellectually dishonest when it comes to safe spaces, when it comes to illegal immigration, when it comes to conversation, when it comes to the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. It's bite one here, and I want you to hear this. It's a little bit shocking that Fareed Zakaria, an extreme leftist, globalist, Marxist, CNN commentator, actually gets the fact that the left is being intellectually dishonest, at least on this one point. Go with it, bite one.
American universities these days seem committed to every kind of diversity except intellectual diversity. Conservative voices and views, already a besieged minority, are being silenced entirely. The campus thought police have gone after serious conservative thinkers like Heather McDonald and Charles Murray, as well as firebrands like Milo Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter. Some were disinvited, others booed, interrupted, and intimidated. It's strange that this is happening on college campuses that promise to give their undergraduates a liberal education. The word liberal in this context has nothing to do with today's partisan language, but refers instead to the Latin root pertaining to liberty. And at the heart of the liberal tradition in the Western world has been freedom of speech.
No.
From the beginning, people understood that this meant protecting and listening to speech with which you disagree.
Oh, no.
Oliver Wendell Holmes once said that when we protect freedom of thought, we are protecting freedom for the thought that we hate.
He actually wrote it.
Freedom of speech and thought is not just for warm, fuzzy ideas that we find comfortable. It's for ideas that we find offensive. There is, as we all know, a kind of anti-intellectualism on the right these days. The denial of facts, of reason, of science. But there is also an anti-intellectualism on the left, an attitude of self-righteousness that says we are so pure, we are so morally superior, we cannot bear to hear an idea with which we disagree.
Mm. So he was on a roll there, and he decided to keep right on going. I mean, when he exited the reservation, he decided, why not just keep right on rolling? Fareed Zakaria, and I'm so shocked by this, that he's actually, there's the blatant disrespect for the American Constitution, the blatant disrespect for fellow citizens and their right to express themselves, even if they disagree with you, because apparently, this might come to a shock to you on the left, but the First Amendment doesn't just apply to things that you think are cool to hear. It's for things that might offend you, might, you know, deeply disturb you, might bother you, might, you know, shake you to your core. Those are the sort of things that are also protected by the First Amendment. Fareed Zakaria, part two. Go.
Liberals think they are tolerant, but often they aren't. In 2016, a Pew study found Democrats were more likely to view Republicans as close-minded, but each side scores about the same in terms of close-mindedness and hostility to hearing contrarian views. And large segments on both sides consider the other to be immoral, lazy, dishonest, and unintelligent.
Mm.
This is not just about tolerance for its own sake. The truth is, no one has a monopoly on right or virtue. Listening to other contradictory views will teach us all something and sharpen our own views. One of the greatest dangers in life, whether it be in business or government, is to get trapped in a bubble of groupthink and never ask, what if I'm wrong? What is the best argument on the other side?
Mm. Good, eh? Lazy. You know, I don't think that the Democrats look at Republicans, or I don't think the liberals look at conservatives as being lazy, but you compare and contrast that to what we heard previously on this program from JFK about lawlessness and so forth, and you wonder, I don't wonder much, JFK could not fit into the Democratic Party today. But it's interesting that Fareed Zakaria, a Marxist, a leftist, a guy that's right out there with the likes of Chris Cuomo and Don Lemon, mental midgets, if you will, when it comes to conservative or liberal or any political conversation for that matter, generally out of touch with the world, don't understand what happens in the middle of the country where you're sitting right now or where you are right now, completely disconnected from America, as they all were prior to the 2016 election, disconnected from America. And here we are, sorting it out, trying to get them to understand intellectual dishonesty. Well, at least they're getting there. Chris Cuomo and Don Lemon are just intellectually defenseless. Fareed Zakaria might have redeemed himself momentarily, but don't expect it to last. He'll return to his Marxist roots sometime soon. It is 14 after the hour. Coming up next, Dr. John Lott, a whole host of new laws affecting gun ownership in Michigan being proposed. Some for guns, some against. We'll talk to him about that whole list right after this on The Steve Gruber Show.
Michigan, born and raised with Midwestern values and Michigan common sense.
Tuesday and getting rolling here through the Steve Gruber Show. Glad you're here listening today. If you'd like to find out more, go to the Steve Gruber Show Facebook page. My next guest, Dr. John Lott, is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. He is a, a guy who studies the numbers, a statistician many times, a scientist, a guy who takes a close look at the truth about guns and gun laws in America. Doctor, welcome back.
Good to talk to you again.
Whole host of ideas being put forth in Michigan, and I thought I'd just ask you about them and see what your, you know, impression of these new laws being proposed are. First, one that would let 18 to 20-year-olds carry concealed pistols. It would change the current age from 21 and reduce it to 18, 19, and 20-year-olds could carry concealed pistols with a concealed pistol license. What do you think of that?
I guess it's kind of the top of my agenda in terms of things to change. But if you look at the rate that permits are revoked for people of that age, it's really not any different than it is for older people. In Michigan, it's possible to break down revocation rates by year of age of permit holder. And you can look at 21 and 22-year-olds, and they actually have a lower rate of revocation than people 23 and older are.
Huh.
So I don't think it's going to make much difference in terms of any problems that you're going to have with 18 and 19,
well,
that's, 20-year-olds.
And that's a fascinating response, because one of the responses I read from one of the opponents said, well, you know, kids' brains are still evolving until they're 25, and they should never have guns. You know, until they're at least, you know, anyhow. So,
right. Well, you may have problems with, you know, 20-year-olds or whatever generally, but the type of person who's going to go through the process to get a concealed carry permit, you know, we can look at the data in other states, and there's just simply no evidence that they are different than older people in terms of revocation rates. But, we know that permit holders are incredibly law-abiding. They lose their permits for any type of firearms-related violations to thousands or tens of thousands of one percentage point. And you can even compare the rates that permit holders are convicted of firearms violations to police. And they, you know, they seem to be convicted of firearms violations at about one-seventh the rate that the police are. And police are convicted at a very, very low rate compared to the general population.
That's interesting. It is fascinating to know how close these people toe the line to make sure that they are not in violation. Now, one of the other proposals being put forth, I know we've talked about this, but constitutional carry being discussed here in Michigan, which would mean no permit whatsoever to carry a concealed pistol license. And for the states that you've studied, that too is not dangerous, correct?
Right. I guess there's, I'm somewhat ambivalent on the topic. I think there's one strong benefit from having permits, and that is related to the discussion that we just had. You're going to have people raise fears about, you know, possible risks of people having carrying guns. And when you have concealed handgun permits, it's possible for me to tell you, look, these people with permits are incredibly law-abiding. You know, they lose their permits at very, very low rates for any type of violations that they commit. But the only way I can go and tell you that is by having permits out there to go and know who's carrying and who's not. If you get rid of permits and have constitutional carry, I don't think you're going to have any problems. But at the same time, when gun control proponents go and argue that it's dangerous out there, in the way we were just talking about for people who are younger, I won't be able to go and make those types of comparisons.
And that's, you know, well, there you go. There's, okay, so here's the next step of this process, because this is curious to me, getting rid of pistol registrations altogether. I don't know what states do that currently. I'm sure you have a pretty good idea. But as you look at this, go ahead.
Almost no states have that. In theory, this is the way they can help stop crime, you know, but when you actually look at it, I don't know, for Michigan, I've tried to inquire, but for other places that have had registration and licensing of guns, like Hawaii or Chicago or Washington, D.C., or Canada, for example, you just can't point to any crimes that have been solved as a result of the registration. You know, and in theory, if a gun's used in a crime and it's left at the crime scene and it's registered to the person who committed the crime, then you can go and identify them and arrest them. But the problem is crime guns are almost never left at the scene. And the few times that they are left there, it's because the criminal's been either killed or seriously wounded. And in the few times they're left there, they're almost never registered guns. And the couple that are registered are never registered to the person who committed the crime. And so, you know, Hawaii, for example, has found no crimes that they could point to that have been solved as a result of registration and licensing. And yet it takes about 50,000 hours worth of police time each year in order to handle that. That's 50,000 hours that we know could be spent on traditional policing, which we know works, or, you know, you could lower taxes, or you could use some of the money to go and spend on education or something else. But simply to have registration and not be able to point to any benefit.
Yeah, you're right. If there's no benefit whatsoever, what are we spending our time on? And only about 30 seconds left because you've covered a lot, but they also want to expand the number of places you could carry a firearm, including financial institutions, churches, theaters, sports arenas, daycare centers, and hospitals. And, of course, with what happened in the UK, I'm sure there'll be a lot of pushback on at least some of this, but I'll give you 20 seconds for the last word.
Sure. Well, I think that's probably one of the more valuable things that could be done. You just had a robbery just a couple days ago in Ohio that was stopped by a concealed carry permit holder at a bank. But, you know, you go and try to create these gun-free zones and shops or whatever, basically it means that the criminals are attracted there. You make it more likely that something bad's going to happen. People go to places where they think victims are defenseless.
There you go, Dr. John Lott. To find out more, go to crimeresearch.org, crimeresearch.org. Doctor, always a pleasure.
Keeping you in touch with Michigan and the world.
It's Tuesday. You're listening to the Steve Gruber Show. We're going to take a little wander through the woods or across the prairie or both, potentially. From the little house in the big woods to the little house in the prairie. Our next guest was part of that journey on Little House of the Prairie. And then began a lifelong journey into television news elsewhere. Melissa Francis, author of Lessons from the Prairie, The Surprising Secrets of Happiness, Success, and Sometimes Just Survival. She learned on America's Favorite Show. Melissa, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, and good morning, Michigan. I've got to tell you, like so many people out there, I'm currently waiting for the school bus right now with my sons. So you'll have to bear with me if you hear a little noise in the background. I'm a mom just like everybody else out there.
Perfectly good. So where do you call home?
New York City. I live in Manhattan now, but you mentioned my career growing up on the prairie. I started out in L.A. I was a child actor doing all kinds of commercials and TV shows until I was on Little House on the Prairie, which is probably the thing I was best known for. But now I am on Fox News Channel and heading there today to do three or four shows. Normal busy day, my friend.
Normal. Well, yeah, and I understand that kind of schedule. Yours seems pretty intense today. You start with a school bus, as we do. Our bus comes a little bit more isolated than yours. But tell me about this first job you got, Little House on the Prairie, the hottest television show. And you joined it at what age?
I was 8. I did it for 2 seasons, and it was an amazing experience. I learned so many things that I realize now at this point in my life have stuck with me. Michael Landon, I don't think a lot of people out there know this, but he was sort of the first entrepreneur, small businessman in Hollywood. He owned that show. He created it. He wrote it. He produced it. He starred in it. He directed the episodes. He was the first one there in the morning and the last one to leave at night. He controlled the budget. He was cheap as heck. He was so tight with a buck. I mean, it was really funny. We would put all our scenes together. He called me one take Missy because I could get it right on the first take. And that was important to him because in those days, we used actual film instead of, you know, digital like they use today. And so
sure.
It was expensive. And what was interesting to me about the experience, and I could even tell this as an 8-year-old because I'd already been on a lot of sets and I was on a lot of sets after that, but it was really a different experience. You know, he had so much pride in the work product, and everybody worked together to put together something that we really thought had value, that would endure, that people enjoyed. And I really learned what it was like to work in a group, work hard. We had a lot of fun, too. You know, I mean, at lunchtime, he would do all kinds of crazy things. He would turn to us to say something, and his mouth opened. A frog popped out at us that he had picked up off the filthy, dirty, steamy valley floor. Just to entertain us, just to make us all laugh. And that's what we did in the off time. But when the camera rolled, he was dead serious, and so were we. And I really learned that sort of pioneering work ethic where you came in, you knew what you had to do, you had pride in it, you got a paycheck at the end of the day. And I realize now, so many years later, that that's sort of a lesson that's been lost. in our country in a lot of ways. And I wrote this book that's just one of the many things that's in there. And it's really a survival guide for my kids.
Well, how do you get from... Kids. Yeah, this is important because I want to jump to this. Melissa Francis with us. You probably know her from Fox News, but if you connect the dots all the way back, you'll find her on Little House on the Prairie with Michael Landon. But how do you get from being a child actor in Hollywood and having, you know, tasted some success like that? Because most, I mean, we hear all sorts of horror stories about child actors, right, you know, gone wrong. You obviously got on your horse, if I'm not mistaken, went to Harvard, then you lost a bet somewhere, because clearly you wouldn't have gone into television news for any other reason. You lost a bet to somebody who was being smart and you were probably drinking at the time. You lost this bet. Why do you go into TV news? All kidding aside.
Well, you know, it's so funny. You're right. You know, I was talking to Melissa Gilbert recently, and she was making the point that none of us ever ended up in rehab or robbing a dry cleaners or any of the other horror stories that have happened to other
it's
actors along the way. And we really do think it's because of the guy. Oh, hang on, Grayson, there's your bus. Go, big guy. Get on out. We really think it was because of the kind of lessons that Michael taught us at an early age to really work hard. And, you know, when I decided that I didn't want to do acting anymore, and I went off to Harvard, I worked all kinds of odd jobs, you know, so that I could break into news and do that those free internships. I worked in the kitchen at Harvard, you know, below ground, chopping up vegetables. I peeled potatoes. I did all that kind of stuff to save up money so that I could go work for free and break into news.
Perfect.
And I realized, you know, when I was in college, I kind of went as far away from Hollywood as I could to see if I wanted to go back. And it was the only thing I'd ever known. I had done my first commercial when I was 6 months old, a Johnson & Johnson baby shampoo commercial. At least that's what I'm told, because I certainly don't remember it.
Sure.
But I had always been on television acting. And what I didn't love about it anymore is I didn't love saying someone else's words. You know, I felt kind of like I was a puppet. And I wanted to go out and, you know, do something that was coming from my own heart and my own brain. And of course, there are actors that can write their own stuff and star in it. You have to be at a pretty high level to get there.
You ever wonder
and
about
I
it?
I decided to kind of start over from scratch. Now, I never really wanted to go back. You know, I love news. It's so exhilarating.
Well, there's a lot to cover these days, that's for sure. Yeah, there's a lot to cover these days because it's breakneck pace every single day. Like I sit here and look at this pile of stories and go, well, any given day, six of these could be a lead story. And, you know, you have to pick one. And this show could be 6 hours a day right now. I'd never cover it all.
It's so true. It's so true, and it's so exhilarating, and it's always fresh and new every day. But, you know, it was hard to get into news. And the funny thing, I talk a lot about this in the book, I got fired from my first on-air job because I didn't realize the news director that hired me thought that there would be some sort of connection between having been in entertainment and being in news. So he hired me and put me on the air thinking that that would be an advantage. Well, the truth is, it's a huge disadvantage because in entertainment, we practice 6,000 times. There are all these rehearsals. It's all scripted. It's on tape. If you mess up, you can do it again. There's someone there doing your hair, your makeup. When you're in local news, it is you and that camera. And the first time I was live, I looked into that black hole that was the camera, and it just sucked the breath out of me. I was terrible. I think I sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher. Wah, wah, wah. I have no idea what I said, but I was terrible. And it was really hard to get started. I got fired from that first job. And I had to scrape myself up off the ground. I was in New Hampshire at the time. I didn't know anyone. I had no family there. I had nobody around. And here I was sitting in the apartment, my apartment, having just been fired from my dream job, what I wanted to do. And I had to scrape myself up off the ground and move on to something better, you know. And there, I have a formula for turning disaster into golden opportunity.
And real quickly, what is
that? Book.
We don't have a lot of time left here, but real quickly, what is your formula? If you can sum it up and, you know, and break
Very
it down.
Quick. Yes. The first thing you do is wallow in a vat of self-pity, really cry and wail and let it all out. Because if you deny the emotion, then it just festers. Then you pick the thing you're going to replace what you lost with. That's even better. I was going to get rehired in a bigger market, bigger than where I was just fired from. Then you take the very first step. Don't map out the whole entire thing. There are too many variables and it's too overwhelming. What's the first step? I made a new resume. One step at a time, very slowly, all of a sudden you're on your way. Step four, when you make it to your new destiny, you look back and you ask yourself, what should I have done differently? What part of this was my fault? A lot of it wasn't, but some part of it was. And you go on. I've had really big challenges in my life. The death of my sister. We all have. I mean, we've all had big things that have knocked us to our knees. But once you learn how to pick yourself up off the ground, you know nothing will ever defeat you. And that is the gift from God of a big defeat, is that when you pick yourself up you know you can.
All right, in 20 seconds.
I go through that and a lot of other things in the book. I hope you'll enjoy it. Lessons from the Prairie. I put my heart and soul into it. I wrote every word. Thank you for talking to me this morning.
There you go. Lessons from the Prairie, the surprising secrets to happiness, success, and sometimes just survival. Melissa Francis, great conversation. Nicely done. I appreciate it. You've apparently learned how to talk to the camera and the microphone. Thank you so much. It's Steve back after this.
Getting your day started with news from around the state and around the world. Common Sense Radio. This is the Steve Gruber Show.
You know, I get the feeling that maybe one of the things that powered people to the polls to elect Donald Trump president of the United States was the no-nonsense approach, the shoot from the hip, the pull no punches, take no prisoners approach that he has to governing and to his conversations. One of the early criticisms of Donald Trump after he was elected was the number of people from the United States military he selected to surround himself with in his administration. It was one of the big knocks on him. Well, look at all the military people in there. As if what? There's going to be some military coup and there's going to be a dictatorship? Come on. Anyhow, one of those, of course, Secretary of Defense James Mattis, known for his frank quotes about the realities of war, offered up a line befitting his nickname Mad Dog during an interview airing on Sunday on Face the Nation with John Dickerson. He was asked, "What keeps you awake at night?" This is from CBS Face the Nation. "What keeps you?" And he said, "Nothing. I keep other people awake at night." It's a great interview, and if you missed it, I want you to hear a couple of minutes of it here. Go ahead.
Is the United States going to take any action to deal with Russia as a threat to NATO, either in helping in the Balkans or in any other way?
Right now, we are dealing with Russia, attempting to deal with Russia under President Trump's direction in a diplomatic manner. At the same time, while willing to engage diplomatically, we are going to have to confront Russia when it comes to areas where they attack us, whether it be with cyber or they try to change borders using armed force. And that's admittedly a strategically uncomfortable position, engaging diplomatically, trying to find a way out of this situation, but confronting them where we must. And we are going to continue in this mode, and hopefully soon our diplomats will work their magic and start moving us out of this this quandary we find ourselves in.
Let me ask you about the Paris Climate Accords. The president is going to make a decision on those.
I was sitting in on some of the discussions in Brussels, by the way, where climate change came up. And the president was open. He was curious about why others were in the position they were in, his counterparts in other nations. And I'm quite certain the president is wide open on this issue as he takes in the pros and cons of that accord.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
Secretary of Defense James Mattis. We'll have more of our interview later in the broadcast.
That's it. Nothing. I keep other people awake at night. John Dickerson, I think that's probably the quote, honestly, the quote of the year. Well, what keeps you awake at night? Nothing. I keep other people awake at night because we're in this annihilation mode, which is where they are right now. They're in this annihilation mode of ISIS. I mean, they are destroying ISIS at a clip like you have never seen before. It is impressive what they are doing there. And despite that, ISIS continues to operate in Baghdad. Militants earlier yesterday claimed responsibility for a nighttime bombing outside a popular ice cream shop. Families and children were there enjoying a late-night snack after breaking their fast for Ramadan. At least 15 died there. A closed-circuit camera of the explosion shows a busy town avenue with cars driving down the street with a massive blast. Then a huge fireball. Cars are scrambling to get away. 15 dead. Al Jazeera reporting that the number of those hurt on the ground and propped themselves on colorful benches outside the shop. It's unclear how many of the dead were children, but the report pointed to at least one girl wearing a ribbon and bow in her hair wandered around in an apartment in a daze after the blast. It's and this is why the president's trip was so successful. This is why the president's trip abroad was so successful to begin with, because the United States is realigning with its Sunni allies that we've had in the past. Now, is this perfect? No. And do I have questions about arming Saudi Arabia the way we are? I certainly do. Tens of billions of dollars, $110 billion initially, and then $350 billion over 10 years. But he was clear, concise, and disciplined. Obviously, those are key ingredients for this president to begin to be on the way to a successful foreign policy. Now, if he can maintain that steadiness and bottle that recipe, if you will, then he would be more successful here at home. But at home, the constant attacks and the drip, drip, drip from the Washington Post, the New York Times, are the constant leaks. The question now being, are those leaks coming somewhere from inside the West Wing? Some say the answer is yes, that these attacks are coming from somewhere inside the West Wing. And if that's true, then you'd have to look at some of the usual suspects. Is Steve Bannon trying to protect his own position? Is Ryan Priebus trying to protect his own position? I say that looking primarily at the Jared Kushner revelations that have happened over the last couple of days, that somehow Jared Kushner is now the focus of the media attention because he set up or attempted to set up a back channel conversation with the Russians in December 2016, which, by the way, is neither unprecedented or particularly interesting. In fact, if you go back to 2014, Barack Obama was doing many of the same things, working behind the scenes for months. He attempted for months, even enlisted the help of Henry Kissinger in 2014 to try to set up a back alley conversation or a back channel conversation with Vladimir Putin. But Putin showed almost no interest in repairing relations with Washington or stopping his aggression at the time in neighboring Ukraine, which has continued. The National Security Council finished an extensive and comprehensive review of U.S. policy toward Russia at that time. This is late 2014. It included dozens of meetings and input from the State Department, Defense Department, several other agencies. Obama made a decision at that time to continue to look for new ways to work with Russia on a host of bilateral and international issues, but he never got anywhere. Press didn't seem to care then that they were using all sorts of back-channel conversations, or that back-channel conversations have gone on for multiple administrations for many, many decades, in fact. It's 52 After on a Tuesday. You're listening to The Steve Gruber Show.